are committed to making the homeless whole again. From treatment for medical, dental, and mental health issues to vocational training to child care and housing placement, Chapman Partnership guides the homeless from hopelessness to self-sufficiency, having served over 90,000 people with a success rate upwards of 62%. You can help the homeless with your support for Chapman Partnership. Details at 877-548-6369 or chapmanpartnership.org.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman will return tomorrow. Today we begin with University of Miami professor Dr. Patty Rose. We'll discuss her book, Cultural Competency for the Health Professional. Welcome to you, Dr. Rose.
Thank you.
A very interesting book. Sum up its main premise, and particularly considering the changing demographics in the U.S.
Okay, so basically, Cultural Competency for the Health Professional is a book that focuses on the whole issue of making sure that health professionals can meet the needs of people from diverse groups. And so cultural competency itself is that process of making sure that people have the skill sets to accomplish that. So that's the premise of the book, essentially. I started this concept of writing this book after teaching at Nova Southeastern University for a period of time. And while I was there, I was asked to teach a course on cultural competency for the medical students. And I realized while doing that, that there was a great need for this kind of work. And beyond lecturing about it and providing information in various forms through conferences and so forth, I thought a book would be a great idea to get this all together and share it on a larger basis.
Are the cultural differences really all that important for doctors, nurses, technicians? I mean, we all work the same way as human beings.
The cultural differences truly matter, because there are cultural nuances that have to be taken into consideration. And the reason for this is to ensure that there aren't problems associated with caring for the patients, and also to make sure that there's optimal customer service, because patients, after all, are in fact customers. They come in for service, they expect that they're going to be acknowledged in terms of who they are. And this can be accomplished in a number of ways. So I'll give you a quick example. Mm-hmm. When a patient comes into a facility for service, usually they have to sit in the waiting room, as I did here as I was waiting to come on the radio with you, correct? So while you're in the waiting room, there are magazines usually, or images on the walls and so forth. If those images and magazines and so forth are not reflective of the patient and or customer, they might not feel at home in that environment. So that's setting the tone. And then when they get to the person who's going to provide them with services, if that person does not acknowledge them in that whole process in terms of their culture and says something inappropriate or makes a comment that is culturally insulting, they could actually lose that patient and offend the patient. So it does matter, because there are differences that have to be addressed.
In the book, Dr. Rose, you talk about racial microaggression. Is that what you're talking about? Where it might even be inadvertent, but it's something that might rub someone the wrong way and create anxiety?
Yes, correct. So a patient might be insulted. Microaggressions are really about insulting a person. There's different types. There's micro insults, there's micro assaults, there's micro invalidations, and so forth, where you might inadvertently invalidate a person or insult them or say something to them that offends them again. And this can have an impact on the care and the relationship between the health professional and the patient. And so we want to be very mindful of that. And cultural competency, having that skill set, prevents you from making that kind of error, because you have a knowledge of this process of being culturally competent and treating a person correctly and not offending them or not insulting them. So yes, it does matter from that vantage point.
Could this, though, make the healthcare professional feel like they have to be walking on eggs all the time?
Well, not if they're
trained.
I don't
want to offend.
Yes. Well, I think not if they're trained. And that's why cultural competency is a skill set, just like any other skill set. So if you're trained in terms of whatever it is that you're doing, you don't have to walk on eggs while you're accomplishing your goal because you know what you're doing. And this is just another one of your myriad skill sets that you bring to the table. So I would say the answer to that would probably be no, if you are in fact culturally competent. And that's what the book sets out to do, to help you to have that skill set.
Even without the cultural competency aspect of things, a lot of patients find that dealing with health professionals can be difficult. And of course, for the most part, you know, they love these professionals and feel great dealing with them, but others may rub them the wrong way.
Absolutely. And remember, it begins even before they get to the health professional. You could be offended by a receptionist. For example, if we look at linguistic competency, perhaps a patient comes in who speaks Spanish as their predominant language, not English. Maybe don't speak English at all. And they come in for care. And someone at the preliminary service level, maybe a receptionist or someone to that effect, says to the patient, well, in order to get service here, you have to speak English. That's a problem right there. Number one, the patient doesn't understand what has been said to them. And there's probably a tone in the body language associated with that. And that doesn't work very well either. So that's even before you get to the health professional. And if you continue to receive that kind of treatment as you go through the process of receiving health care, the person can feel very intimidated, offended, and there can be problems in that rapport and customer service.
So what kind of recommendations do you make to encourage cultural competency in the medical education system, such as the University of Miami School of Medicine?
Well, the University of Miami, as indicated in the book, because you're aware, I interviewed Dr. Donna Shalala, who's the president of the university. And what I found was something that I'm very excited about, and that is that at the University of Miami, for their medical students, they actually provide them with language training. So many of their medical students will actually learn Spanish and actually travel to places where they can enhance that ability. For example, a rotation in Costa Rica, where they can enhance their language abilities. Also, the curriculum needs to have a course that is specifically geared toward cultural competency. In that course, they learn about different cultures, they learn about language differences, visual affirmation, all of those wonderful things that will help to ensure that the patient gets optimal care. So it's at the curriculum level that this has to be addressed. Actual cultural competency and diversity courses.
We're speaking with Dr. Patty Rose, University of Miami professor. She's the author of the book Cultural Competency for the Health Professional. Dr. Rose, tell us a little bit more about your background and how you came to be so interested in this aspect of the medical profession, which I guess not too many people really consider.
All right. Well, I started my education at the graduate level at Yale University, where I attended the School of Epidemiology and Public Health. So I actually have a master's degree in public health in health services administration. So my first book on this subject was for health administrators and public health practitioners, because I believe that you have to start at the top when dealing with the cultural competency issue. If the board of directors, the president, and other administrators are not going for it within their healthcare organization, then it's not going to work. So I have training in that area and understand how to communicate with health administrators and so forth. Subsequent to that, I went to Columbia University, where I received my doctorate in health education. And I think that's extremely beneficial because health education is more people, one-on-one educational oriented. So in that scenario, I learned about the importance of educating individuals, patients, and so forth around health issues. And in between that, between the master's and the doctorate, I worked as a research coordinator in New York City for the National Hemophilia Foundation. I've also served as a vice president and president of community health centers, federally qualified community health centers,
one of them
being here. Yes, the Jesse Trice Center for Community Health. It used to be Economic Opportunity Family Health Center, but the name has since changed. So I was the vice president of the behavioral health division there, and then president of Plainfield Health Center, which is another community health center in New Jersey. But now I'm at the university teaching and loving that.
Well, we're speaking with Dr. Patty Rose about cultural competency in the medical profession. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll also be joined by University of Miami President Donna Shalala. Stay with us.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. City Year Miami unites a diverse group of 17 to 24-year-olds for a year of service as tutors, mentors, and role models who make a difference to students and schools. You can learn more online at cityyear.org. City Year. Give a year. Change the world.
Palm Beach Drama Works presents Edward Albee's dark comedy, A Delicate Balance. This Pulitzer Prize-winning play follows a well-to-do suburban family whose life is upended when friends, seized by a nameless terror, come to live with them. This is a rare chance to see Tony Award nominee Maureen Anderman and Carbonell Award winners Angie Radosh and Dennis Cregan in A Delicate Balance. Strictly limited engagement now through January 6th at Palm Beach Drama Works on Clematis Street, West Palm Beach, 561-514-4042 or palmbeachdramaworks.org. The James Brown sound owes much credit to Super Sax legend Maceo Parker. Hear that funky sax solo? Parker and the King of Soul recorded it right here in Miami in 1965. Joined by Grammy-nominated sax icon Candy Dulfer, who has recorded with everyone from Prince to Chaka Khan to Aretha Franklin, the irresistible grooves of jazz funk take over with Super Sax. Friday, December 14th at the Arsht Center. Information at arshtcenter.org.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we're back 18 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you on this Wednesday afternoon. And we're visiting with University of Miami professor Dr. Patty Rose. We're discussing her book, Cultural Competency for the Health Professional. Joining us now by phone is Dr. Donna Shalala, of course, the president of the University of Miami, but also the former Secretary of Health and Human Services for 8 years in the Clinton administration. Dr. Shalala, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Patty.
Hi, how are you?
Your Dr. Shalala, your thoughts on changing demographics and healthcare with your great experience?
Well, the demographics are obviously changing, and we're not going to get healthcare quality unless we understand both those changing demographics and a lot about the culture of the people who are coming into the healthcare system.
Now, I suppose that most UM medical graduates are bilingual and are also being educated in this cultural competency business for their patients.
Well, not only are a very large percentage of our students bilingual, but more importantly, a very large percentage, increasingly, in fact, large percentage, are getting masters in public health. So they have a background that's more population-based at the same time they're getting their MD degrees. And that's absolutely spectacular. I think a quarter of the class this year, we're going to move it up to a third.
Dr. Shalala, also touch on healthcare reform and immigration and the cultural competency, where you may have people who are undocumented and have a lot of anxiety trying to seek medical treatment.
Well, what we're going to do with the new healthcare reform is reduce the number of people without health insurance. That actually will free up some space for others who are not eligible for health care reform. And, of course, people who are here illegally are not eligible. The problem with people who have questionable immigration status is while they can go to emergency rooms and they can go to free clinics, obviously, the health care system is not really designed in a seamless way for them. Hopefully, the discussion of immigration reform will also be a discussion of what we do about a seamless healthcare system for people who are here in this country, who aren't going anyplace, but for whom we feel a sense of responsibility. And in fact, if they and their children don't get healthcare, it puts the rest of us at risk. because you want their children to get immunized. You want them to have good health care. You don't want to run up costs in the health care system. And it helps if health care is available to all.
Both doctors, if you could address that, doesn't some of this business with undocumented immigrants, that some centers just kind of look the other way and treat them and don't, they know they're not going to be reimbursed, but they just absorb the cost?
Well, I think we should separate, of course that happens, we should separate between those that don't have insurance and have documentation and those that don't have documentation. It's very difficult to tell. The truth is that the healthcare system under the law must admit people to emergency rooms no matter what their status is. The question is what happens after a person is stabilized and whether they have access to the kind of quality care that we all believe that everyone in this country ought to have access to. And that's complicated depending on where you live and how the healthcare system behaves. There's no uniformity in what happens afterwards. We do know that people have to be accepted into emergency rooms.
Yes, and I would have to say that I agree with that, because if you take a look at, for example, what we were referring to before, community health centers, the federally qualified community health centers, many of them actually serve individuals that are undocumented. And as was indicated in the book, this is really sort of a don't ask, don't tell kind of scenario, in that individuals' immigration status is not queried. And so as a result, people receive services. And under the law, EMTALA, in fact, yes, a person can go into the emergency room, get stabilized, and receive care. But the question is, what happens after that scenario if they have long-term health care needs, and how are they served? And in the process of serving them, beyond altruism in terms of cultural competency and just doing the right thing and making sure that individuals are treated properly, there's also a business aspect to this. When health care reform actually kicks in full effect in 2014, what we're going to find is that there's going to be an expansion of the minority, or as I like to refer to them, emerging majority market. And so healthcare organizations will actually seek out these individuals that need care regardless of their status, focusing on the fact that they're documented, presumably that they're documented, and provide them with care from that vantage point. And hopefully at that time it will in fact be culturally competent.
Both doctors, you've touched on services, of course, for emergency room where anyone must be treated. But how about long-term care for chronic illness for undocumented persons?
It's very scattered in terms of that being available. But for many communities, they absorb long-term care into their own families. The fact is, long-term care is a mess for everyone, whether you're documented or undocumented, whether you have insurance or don't have insurance. Long-term care insurance is a relatively new phenomena in many ethnic families, including my own. Elderly are taken care of within the family. My mother is 101 years old, and she's at home with help. That's expensive for many families, and for most of us, the caregiving is done by members of the family. So we have to be careful that we distinguish between what is a national problem for everyone and what is a particular problem for a population that doesn't have access to insurance. I also want to make the point about the large number of people that are coming into the insurance system who don't have insurance now. The vast majority of them are working, or their families who may or may not, their kids and spouses who may or may not be working. But most people who don't have insurance in this country and are legal get up every morning and go to work. They simply can't afford health insurance or work in a series of part-time jobs where it's not offered. So what the United States government and the people of the United States are doing is offering affordable health insurance to working people.
Dr. Shalala, in your interview with Dr. Rose that's in the Cultural Competency book, you particularly comment about the Leon Centers in Miami, which cater to elderly Hispanics, particularly of Cuban descent. Touch on that.
Well, it's an interesting niche in the market. It exists in other places. Onlook in San Francisco for the Chinese and the Asian population. These are, when you put together a heterogeneous population in a certain age group, you can design services specifically for that population, totally culturally competent, and make money at the same time. And Lyon is an example of that, as the Onluck system is in California. But where you have large ethnic populations, there's a center in, I think it's Detroit or Flint, for Arab Americans, and it's a clinic that caters particularly to that population. Where you have large concentrations, people have found a way to design a healthcare system that fits that particular population.
Yes, and I believe that is correct. And as I discuss in a very detailed manner in the book, this really needs to be part of the strategic plan of the organization. So a healthcare organization, just like any other business, has a strategic plan. So within the context of that, there should be information and details and specifics about techniques, about how to approach the process of diversifying staff, and understanding that diversifying staff doesn't accomplish cultural competency. Because just because you have a diversified staff doesn't mean that they have the skill set to serve the population optimally on a cultural basis, and also enhance customer service and avoiding malpractice. All of this goes into the strategic plan. So I believe what is being discussed here with these organizations that have what appears to be excellent cultural competency in place is that they actually planned for it. It's not a random scenario. So healthcare organizations should take that into consideration. And that's where we begin to look at the health administration and board of directors and so forth. And then that filters to the health professionals who actually provide service.
Both of you.
It is more complicated, though, when you have multiple ethnic groups and a relatively small clinic. There are all sorts of techniques for dealing with that, but often you can't cover all the languages, for example, and a family member has to come in. But then the healthcare professionals have to be trained to use translators to ask questions appropriately, and they ought to know something about multiple cultures.
Agreed.
Both of you have discussed about this healthcare competency, cultural competency in medical schools and nursing schools, but what about for established professionals who haven't had the opportunity for this? Is there a way they can be retrained a little bit and get an
update? Absolutely.
Yes, I agree. And the title of the book is Cultural Competency for the Health Professional. And that's a very, very good question, because in writing this book, although it is a textbook that can be utilized by students and is utilized by students, the purpose of the book is to also assist individuals who are already in practice. So the book actually has a companion website so that professionals can go there and they can go through case studies and other activities to ensure that they understand the process on a hands-on basis and so forth. So I believe that I wrote this book not just for the students, although it is for students, but also for actual practicing health professionals, because this is something that is evolving and changing on a regular basis. It's not a static scenario. So we have a different influx of demographics and different populations coming in on a regular basis.
Well, Dr. Rose, we only have a little bit of time left, so how about giving that website to where people can learn more?
Sure. The website, there's actually two. One is www.jblearning.com, and that's where you can actually acquire the book. And the website for these activities that I referred to, it's a little long, but it's http://go.jblearning.com.
How about something they can just Google?
They can just go, well, this one is specific, so it's jblearning.com/culturalcompetencyCWS.
And also, we'll have some links on the Topical Currents Facebook page this evening. Certainly want to thank you, Dr. Patty Rose. She's the author of Cultural Competency for the Health Professional. Thank you very much for coming by
and joining us. Thank you, Dr. Shalala.
Also, thanks to Dr. Donna Shalala, of course, President of the University of Miami. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Ariel Gonzalez is next.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. NPR for the Florida Keys is 91.5 WKWM. You've reached a certain age, you're viewed as a success, still you're not immune. The disease of addiction doesn't discriminate based on age or status. West Palm Beach's Hanley Center is considered a center of excellence for comprehensive addiction treatment and recovery for older adults and baby boomers. Hanley Center for Older Adults and Boomer Recovery, details at 855-718-2233. Hanley Center Recovery for Life, 855-718-2233. We're funded by listeners like you and by ConservArt, specializing in restoration and custom framing for the care, conservation, and displaying of fine art. Insurance claims are a specialty. A complete list of services offered is at conservart.net.
Back by popular demand, The Sandaland Diaries, the gleeful Christmas rant by David Sedaris, master American satirist, features audience favorite Michael McKeever in this hilarious, critically acclaimed holiday hit. Opening in Boca Raton's Meisner Park on December 13th. Tickets at 866-811-4111. That's 866-811-4111 or paradeproductions.org. The Sandaland Diaries, a delightfully twisted grown-up holiday treat.
And we return. It's Topical Currents. I'm Joseph Cooper. Bonnie Berman returns tomorrow. 2012 was a very good year for Juno Diaz. His latest work, This Is How You Lose Her, hit the bestseller list and was nominated for the National Book Award. Not enough? Then throw in a $500,000 genius grant from the MacArthur Foundation. 5 years ago, Diaz received a Pulitzer Prize for his novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Woe. But in This Is How You Lose Her, Diaz returns to the short story form. He follows a young Dominican-American man whose inability to remain faithful to his girlfriends doom him to continued unhappiness. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez next speaks with Diaz. He began by asking him why his hero is so sexually adventurous.
Well, I think half the stories are about this poor kid dealing with his brother's slow death through cancer. But the other half of the stories, we have a guy who is clearly allergic to intimacy.
Well, how much of his allergy is due to his ethnic background, to the Latino macho culture?
I always think that's the easy go-to, but it's not as if, like, people in the United States don't cheat as much as they cheat in the Caribbean, you know? I mean, the case that is the book makes about why Junior is the way he is has a lot to do with his specific family. Now, could there be a family like this outside of the Dominican Republic? I think so. You know, a family where the mother's indifferent to Junior, where the father loathes him, where the brother is brutal, where the family's entire economy of masculinity is that boys should always go after girls. I don't know. I don't think he's such an unusual thing, whether in Santo Domingo or in New Jersey.
Well, your hero, Junior, we've seen him before. He's the protagonist of your first book, Drown. Like This Is How You Lose Her, Drown is a series of interconnected stories. You also had Junior serve as the narrator of your novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. What is it about Junior that makes you return to him again and again?
He's kind of a difficult, ornery character for me. He's, in some ways, he's a good challenge. You know, there's some challenges that bring out the best in you as an artist, and he brings out the best in me. He's, at one hand, he's kind of familiar. I've given him a lot of the same stuff I have. Jersey, Dominican, Rutgers, likes books. On the other hand, he's really, really different. He's much more lonely, much more haunted, much more troubled, much more into hiding himself. And I think he's a really good guide, like an excellent guide for many of the sort of issues and topics that most interest me. In this case, it's how do we talk as men to ourselves seriously about what's wrong with our masculinity?
We're speaking with author Juno Diaz about his new book, This Is How You Lose Her. There are 9 stories in this book. 8 of them deal with Junior. Tell us about the one that doesn't.
That one, I think I was being too cute. I was being too smart. That story is actually a story that Junior writes about the other woman in his family's life, the It's about a Dominican woman in New Jersey, brand new immigrant in the middle of winter with a husband who has a wife back home. Now, anyone who's read my first book, Drown, recognizes the husband, Ramon, as Junior's father, the woman back in the Dominican Republic as Junior's mother, and this is the woman that almost tore the family apart. And so it makes sense when you put the books together, but when you don't have the books together, it just feels like a story about a Dominican immigrant in New Jersey and her struggles to find a home and to deal with this kind of cheating, crazy guy.
Mm. Well, this book opens with a story called The Sun, the Moon, the Stars. Here, Junior is again in trouble with a girl. He's always in trouble. He's cheated on his Cuban girlfriend. And to make amends, he takes her on a vacation to the Dominican Republic. They stay at an expensive resort. This gives you a chance to show the sharp economic and racial divide in the Dominican Republic. Tell us about Casa de Campo.
Man, you know, this is a crazy story that I took me a while to write, but anyone who's ever been to a resort in the Caribbean knows that these things are almost perfectly built as a textbook example of racial, cultural, class divides in the society which it takes place. And Casa de Campo, I think, is perhaps the most perfect textbook to describe sort of the crazy levels in Dominican society. On one hand, all the workers there are dark-skinned Dominicans, Haitian as well, and that mean the workers who do the hard work, and all the folks who do the kind of quote-unquote more intellectual work, they're lighter skin. And in the place that I was writing about in Casa de Campo, you almost never see Dominicans as guests. You always see foreigners as guests. And Junior and his girlfriend are the kind of the only Latinos in this one resort. And Junior's looking around and he's like, my God, this is an insane place for me to be while I'm trying to make up with my girlfriend.
It's funny because on a recent episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians, the Kardashians went to Casa de Campo.
We are not surprised.
Yes. And of course, you should not be surprised that they did not interact with any run-of-the-mill Dominicans at that time.
No. My God.
In fact, what impressed me about it is it reminds me of Cuba. In Cuba, there's something called tourist apartheid, where they separate the Cubans from the tourists. Or again, the Cubans, you know, they're just worker bees. They're worker bees at these resorts, and you know, the dollar is of course the king.
I've been to Cuba twice, and let me tell you, the exact apartheid you're talking about is what's happening in a place like the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
Yeah, that's what I noticed. We're speaking with author Juno Diaz about his new book, This Is How You Lose Her. Now, in The Sun, the Moon, the Stars, the spirit of Rafael Trujillo still hangs over the Dominican Republic. Trujillo was a dictator of the DR for about 30 years. He controlled every aspect of the country. He was assassinated 50 years ago, but people still talk about him in hushed tones. Cubans can understand this. It may take two or three generations to wipe Fidel Castro's memory from the island. Is this the triumph or the final triumph of the dictator, that their legacy of fear and demoralization outlives them?
I think that when you have a society like the Dominican Republic that spent 31 years completely kidnapped by one psychotic personality who saturated, deformed, and captured almost every aspect of the society. And listen, Cuba, not to have any comparisons, but Cuba had a very active intellectual world before Fidel. It had a very active connection to the larger Caribbean, to the larger Latin America. In many ways, the Dominican Republic was more vulnerable because the Dominican Republic begins in a more isolated place with far less connections. Our intelligentsia, the sort of global cosmopolitan figures, were very, very small. And Trujillo was able to murder and drive most of them out. So it's, I think, in the end, societies that have these situations, it's going to take generations, and it's also going to take conscious work. It doesn't just go away because of time. You have to have something as close to a truth commission to face it. And most societies don't have, you know, they don't have the heart for it.
Well, Junior has a brother, Rafa. He treats women even more badly than Junior. He's rude to his mother. He's extremely violent. But in the story, the Pura principal, he's dying of cancer. And he's not dying easily. He's raging against the dying of the light. I found him fascinating. I wouldn't want to spend a minute in his company, but I admired his tenacity. Is that how you make an unlikable character likable?
Well, I think part of it is, do we see the humanity? Do we connect? You know, you don't want people to like your characters. I actually don't care if anyone likes my characters. I just want them to find in them what is human, to connect. And Rafa, like you said, he's a piece of work. And seeing how he reacts to his inevitable mortality, that he is going to die, in some ways, you kind of, like you said, there's a part of you that kind of admires him. Because I'll tell you what, if I was in his situation, my cowardice would show through in ways that I think I couldn't even predict.
Yeah, curled up in a fetal position.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, he's a damaging figure, like you said. I mean, he certainly doesn't make life easy for his family while he's going down. But boy, oh boy, again, this guy's got a lot of heart.
Junior is your alter ego. You're Nathan Zuckerman. Nowhere more so, I think, than in The Cheater's Guide to Love, the last story of this collection. There are a lot of parallels between Junior's life and your own. Do you ever hesitate when you want to perhaps mine your life or borrow from it for fiction?
Yeah, but you know, Junior is like a very close, friend in certain ways. So I let Junior use my resume, I let him use my clothes, I let him use my apartment, but he can't use my friends and he can't use my exes. So in many ways, while he's close to me, most of his problems are his own and invented for him specifically. Now, is this to say that I haven't had trouble with intimacy? No, that's not the case. But I've invented a different pathology for Junior, which allows him to be independent of me. And so I don't feel like I mind too close. I definitely mind my family, because I feel like a family, the least they owe you is a book or two.
No, that's good. But so in other words, in that story, the friends, the exes, they are invented.
Well, one friend is not invented. There's his female friend, Arlenny, is actually a real friend I have. But the rest of his friend, Elvis, is invented. All those exes, those women he runs into, are invented. Because otherwise, I like living where I like living. I like my friends. I don't want people to be mad at me.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with author Juno Diaz. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN.
What may be South Florida's most beloved holiday tradition returns December 8th through the 18th with Seraphic Fire's Grammy-nominated Candlelight Christmas Concerts. Timeless carols and beautiful Gregorian chant combine into a concert experience the Miami Herald calls gorgeous and evocative. There are performances across South Florida. Two concerts are already sold out. Tickets at 305-285-9060 or seraphicfire.org. The University of Miami is still accepting applications for the January start of its MBA for Working Professionals and Executive MBA programs. With evening and weekend classes, these programs enable you to earn the UM MBA without interrupting your career. Both include an international study option and a variety of elective options, so you can design your program to best meet your own career goals. Now is the time to apply for classes that begin in January. More about the streamlined application process at miamimba.com. That's miamimba.com.
Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Juno Diaz, whose latest book is a collection of short stories entitled This Is How You Lose Her. Juno, in the last segment, we were discussing The Cheater's Guide to Love, the last story in this collection. It's a long short story. I'd call it a novella. Recently, Ian McEwan wrote a piece celebrating the novella. It's the Goldilocks of fiction, not too long, not too short. With the advent of ebooks, do you think the novella's popularity will rise?
Well, one hopes. It's an awkward form. There's a lot of talking about novellas among writers. But it's one of the forms that I always was attracted to, especially for a final piece. I think a longer story works well. But again, the dream, anytime that there's a new way for people to get their work across, the dream always is that this will increase readership, that this will increase access. But, you know, you just got to cross your fingers and hope. I don't know yet if it's going to come true.
You're quite a reader. I read an interview where you said you read a book a week.
Yeah, try to.
Is that true?
Yeah, try to.
And you own 2 storage units full of books?
Yeah, I rent them, but yeah.
You rent.
Actually, it's 3, but right. I won't lie. It's actually 3 storage units.
3 storage units?
Yeah.
Full of books?
Yep.
How do you read as much as you do and still find time to write?
Well, part of it is I write slow and very little each day. I'm not one of those people who burrows in 10, 12 hours. That's just not the way I do it. Reading, in many ways, is my primary pleasure. In some ways, I think that being a writer is just an excuse to be around books.
What are you reading now?
Well, I always kind of have these sort of Saturn returns where I go back to old stuff that I really love. Right now, I'm halfway through Stephen King's It, which is really kind of remarkable, you know. I am reading Louise Erdrich's The Roundhouse, a novel that's extraordinary. It's been nominated for the National Book Award.
And as your book has been nominated for the National Book Award.
Right. But, I mean, this is, you know, okay, yeah, but this is kind of a colossal novel, really amazing.
You're a big science fiction fan. I know you read a tremendous amount of science fiction. What the genres, or is,
sure.
You know, that's what Oscar Wilde calls them with the capital G, the genres.
Yeah.
Monstrel. I know it's a work in progress, and you don't perhaps want to talk about it too much, but a excerpt, let's say, was published in The New Yorker.
Yep. Yeah.
And Monstro is something you've been working on for some time now.
Yeah.
It's a science fiction story set in the Caribbean. At least tell us about the piece that appeared in The New Yorker. What is Monstro about?
Yeah, Monstro is hopefully my next novel, whenever it will finish, hopefully within less than 10 years. And it's about a group of Dominican friends, Dominican Americans and Dominicans, on the island during the hottest summer in a slight future from now, when a very strange disease begins to afflict the poorest and most vulnerable people on the island. And this disease seems to be partially a possession, partially an alien invasion, and it begins to produce monsters. And so it's kind of an invasion story, which is in the Caribbean, we know, is a familiar narrative.
Well, I once told someone that if you go to a third world nation, you're seeing a post-apocalyptic society.
No question.
People don't realize that when you see TV shows like The Walking Dead and so on, those are third world nations.
No question. And that the imaginary of the first world, when the first world wants to imagine the post-apocalypse, the grammar that they use is their visions of the third world.
That's true, yes. We're speaking with author Junot Diaz about his new book, This Is How You Lose Her. Whenever I give students one of your stories to read, they always ask the same question. Why doesn't he place quotation marks around his dialogue? Care to answer?
God, I feel bad for that. That's just the tick that I picked up because I was such a huge fan of Cormac McCarthy, and I am a huge fan. And also because Cormac McCarthy doesn't put quotations. You know, it's one of his affects and one of his affectations, excuse me. And the other thing, though, is because so much of what I write is about a character trying to remember, that I like the confusion between what he's remembering he thought and what he's remembering he said. Sometimes we confuse that, and I think the italics helps me to kind of get that across.
Well, you're also fond of the second person point of view. This is when a narrator addresses himself as you. In her review of your new book, Francine Prose spanked you a little bit about that. I'm a fan of the second person point of view. What is the attraction to that particular point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I actually read that Francine Prose that review, and it's interesting for how little it reveals that she read the book. It felt like, again, if that had come across from one of my students, we would have to fail them because there's no evidence that she read the book. She spends all this time talking about who she thinks I might be instead of sort of addressing the text, and which is embarrassing. I always thought much better of Francine. I'm a huge fan. And the second person itself is, I find to be a useful form because it's in one hand alienating and on the other hand, very, very intimate at the same time. And therefore, for me, presents a peculiarly fascinating challenge.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a liberating point of view for a writer.
And it just gets out of space which nothing else gets at.
Mm-hmm. In 2010, you wrote a piece for The New Yorker in which you criticized President Obama's storytelling skills.
I did.
You didn't believe he'd provided the public with a coherent and invigorating narrative. As a result, this has made him vulnerable to the narratives of his enemies. This is what you wrote. A man cannot withstand a story, even if the man is remarkable and the story is simple. The story always wins. This president has a writerly mind. He's a writer. Why do you think he's had a problem with framing the narrative? And now that he's been reelected, do you think he's learned his lesson?
I hope so. I mean, I really do hope so. He's learned his lesson. I really want to see a better president than the one we've gotten. A part of me just wonders if he, A, lacks the fight that is required to be a politician. To be a politician, you got to be like a Bill Clinton. You got to like the fight. You got to like to roll your sleeves up and get in there. And I don't think he likes that. I think his ideas were kind of revealed in these last 4 years that he tends to think that being a conciliator is a good thing, but not in our politics. You got to be a fighter. And I sometimes wonder if he's not a little bit too distant and too brainy. And this is coming from somebody who's brainy and distant. He seems like an extreme example.
But again, the strange thing is in terms of narrative of storytelling, because we know he can tell a story. He's written his memoir, which is a fascinating book. But could it be that he just can tell? He's very good at telling his own story, but when it comes to telling the story of an administration, that's more of a problem.
No, I think you're right. It's like everybody said about Mitt Romney. You heard how everybody said, if you know Mitt Romney, he's very warm, he's very charming, but as soon as Mitt Romney gets in front of a camera, he's like a zombie, you know? And I think that perhaps you're 100% right that in various mediums, we have strengths. And I think certainly when it comes to selling himself, Obama is unmatched, is peerless. But I think it's quite a different thing of making a story about a nation.
Well, Latinos were instrumental in the president's reelection.
You mean we gave him the reelection?
Yes, I think you can say that, yes. You may not want to give them advice, but what can the Republicans do to win the Latino vote?
I think the Republicans have to do something which for them would mean the end of their party as they imagine it. I think that they would have to abandon white supremacy. And the Republican Party is like an undead vampire whose blood, the old blood that runs through it, is white supremacy. And they would have to literally abandon their xenophobia. They would have to abandon their coded attacks against blacks and against Latinos. I mean, think about how much of the planks of their platform is made up of just coddling and providing comfort for people who hate people of color. And I think what happened in this election was that groups who everyone claims have nothing in common reacted incredibly strongly to 4 years of this kind of Republican race baiting, xenophobia, and racism. And you had Asians, you had Latinos, you had African Americans, communities everybody said have nothing in common. Well, they had one thing in common, that they were sick and tired of this Republican reflex of being so incredibly hateful. If the Republican Party wants to have any future outside of being white supremacist in this country, they need to alter that platform and start talking about how they're fiscally conservative and get rid of this cultural nonsense that makes them the home of every racist kook in this country.
Yes, and yet they can no longer appeal, I think, to angry old white men, because angry old white men die. They will die off. And you have, again, 60% of young people who voted for Obama this time. So they're losing the next generation.
Without a question. But, you know, I think there's always tricks to get folks to vote against their best interest. I mean, I think we've seen the Republicans are unmatched at this. Certainly, you're right. I think that it would be a dream if the Republican Party actually became a conservative party and stopped being a racist reactionary party. We could use a good conservative party in this country. We certainly don't have one.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Juno Diaz.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. So thanks for listening this hour. Topical Currents producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Find free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. We also have author and book links, discussion, and staff photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow, we begin with Children's Movement of Florida Chairman David Lawrence. Also, Grubstake Good Works Director Heather Klinker. It's the pride of Wynwood. And today's calendar, on this day in 1926, 85 years ago, the birth of blues legend Big Mama Thornton in Montgomery, Alabama. She made early recordings of Hound Dog and Ball and Chain. And on this day in 1964, 47 years ago, the death of soul singer Sam Cooke. He was shot to death in a Los Angeles motel room by the manager who claimed self-defense. You Send Me, Chain Gang, Twisting the Night Away. One more while we remember the rumble in the jungle. On this day in 1981, 27 years ago, boxing champion Muhammad Ali's last fight. He loses a unanimous decision to Trevor Burbick in the Bahamas. 14 months before, he had lost the only non-decision of his career to champion Larry Holmes. Ali won his first pro fight, of course, as Cassius Clay in 1960. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. And we leave with a thought from Muhammad Ali, who was influenced by flamboyant wrestler Gorgeous George. Quote, "I never thought of losing, but now that it's happened, the only thing is to do it right. That's my obligation to all the people who believe in me. We all have to take defeats in life." This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.
This is 91.